It's a unique and important position, partly in the spotlight, partly behind the scenes. This hour, the U.S. Vice Presidency. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, presidential historian Tim Walch and political scientist Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa examine the role of the second in command of our nation throughout history and how VPs have served their presidents in different ways. It's a relationship that's sometimes cold, sometimes close, always complicated. A heartbeat away from the presidency. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a unique and important position, partly in the spotlight, partly behind the scenes. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, the U.S. Vice Presidency in historical perspective. Today, presidential historian Tim Walch joins us once again, along with political scientist Donna Hoffman. Donna, associate professor and chair of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Hello, Donna.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Tim Walch, so nice to see you in the Iowa City studio. Former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Thanks for coming by.
You bet. Good to be with you and Donna.
This is all about vice presidents. We'll be hearing Donna's stories, Tim's stories about vice presidents of the past. We'd like to have you join our conversation with your comments, your questions about vice presidents and the role that they have played in U.S. history. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can email us as well, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tim, take us back to the beginning of this evolution, because as we'll see, it is an office that has evolved and changed also with each sort of nuance of each president. What did the founding fathers want? Why did they have the vice president?
Well, quite frankly, in a few words, they didn't think very much of it. In fact, John Adams, our first vice president, considered it the most insignificant office known to man. And in fact, even many years later, there was a comedian who had a wonderful ditty which went like this. There once was a man who had two sons. They both left home and were never heard from again. One was a ship captain lost at sea, and the other became vice president of the United States. And so, in truth, it was a legislative office. The only prescription or work assignment that the vice president has is to preside over the Senate. He is the president of the Senate and votes in the case of a tie on votes in the Senate. But even at its earliest stages, there never was a presumption that the vice president of the United States would succeed to the presidency if something happened to the president. And we faced a crisis, of course, when William Henry Harrison died suddenly after a 30-day presidency. And John Tyler took it upon himself to almost insist that he be sworn in as president. And even though some addressed him as acting president, he would refuse to answer the correspondence, and it became tradition without any specific case law that the vice president would succeed to the presidency. Of course, behind his back, they called John Tyler his accidency. And so it's always been a question of how the office has evolved. And of course, as we've gone on, it was, I think, Thomas Marshall, the vice president under Woodrow Wilson, who was the first vice president to attend cabinet meetings. He remember, as a legislative officer, the vice president wasn't presumed to be a member of the executive branch. And then gradually moving up through to Walter Mondale, the vice president has an office in the Oval Office and meets regularly with the president, and he becomes a close advisor to the president on all issues. And with each successive vice president since Mondale, we have seen a growth in power up through and certainly in including Vice President Cheney.
Donna Hoffman, when you think about how the vice presidency has changed over the years, evolved, what comes to mind for you?
I think there's one big way that we can distinguish these that Tim kind of got at. So in the 19th century, presidents were generally seen to be more legislative. And then in the 20th century, once we got into modern government, and, you know, that doesn't exactly start at the turn of the 20 into the 20th century, but, you know, essentially we date that to Franklin Roosevelt. Then they start to play a larger role in terms of the executive branch, and they are much less found to be presiding over the Senate. And as a matter of fact, it's something that virtually the vice president in the modern era doesn't do at all. Yet you did have some presidents, some vice presidents or presidents of the Senate doing that in the 19th century. So that's kind of a good way to think of it. But even in the modern era, you know, which I generally look at, there's a lot of evolution, yes, with those powers increasing. But at the same time, a lot of things that are situational between presidents and their vice presidents, but also things that a lot of times the power in that office may also depend on what the personal relationship is mm-hmm. with the president and the vice president. And there can be jealousies and there can be you may be seen as the heir apparent in the next election that may or may not sit comfortably with the person who's sitting in that number one chair. And so there's a lot of personalities and many times very large personalities, right? Because people who think they can be president usually have fairly big egos, brought into this relationship that can affect the actual workings and what the vice president done and even the powers of that office.
Right. We don't have time to go through all of our vice presidents. What are there? 48 vice presidents who have served the U.S. 8 of them have risen to the Oval Office because of a president's death or assassination. 1 became president after his boss's resignation. We'll just let that kind of flutter out there as some trivia. I know most of you know the answer to that one. Let's go. You talked about big personalities, Don. I wanted to have you expand on this because big personalities, we could point to LBJ, President Johnson, and before him, President Kennedy. I want to have you comment on their president-vice president relationship. But before that, let's listen to some archive audio. Just 5 days after the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas, the nation's new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, addressed a joint session of Congress calling for Americans to push onward.
On the 20th day of January in 1961, John F. Kennedy told his countrymen that our national work would not be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But he said, let us begin. Today, in this moment of new resolve, I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue. This is our challenge, not to hesitate, not to pause, not to turn about and linger over this evil moment, but to continue on our course so that we may fulfill the destiny that history has set for us.
Of course, Johnson ascending to the presidency after the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. Donna, let me turn to you. So what can you tell us about their president-vice president relationship, how they got together on one ticket?
Well, LBJ, if you read the Robert Caro books on LBJ, which span his whole life, essentially, you really get the picture of LBJ, and he's one of the, I think, the most interesting people to both be vice president and then president. And he was nothing if not a savvy politician and a shameless self-promoter. And, you know, one of the things he was doing in that clip that you played was to utilize the national tragedy of Kennedy's assassination and push a political agenda forward, push Lyndon Johnson's agenda forward. And he was very masterful in using the emotions that the country was feeling with the Kennedy assassination and using those in terms of how he would govern. But prior to that, you know, LBJ essentially ran for the nomination in 1960. He actually didn't participate in any of the presidential primaries in that year, but it was a different era in terms of presidential primaries and nominations. So he didn't really need to, and he didn't really need to because he was an established figure within the Democratic Party. And Kennedy, of course, was seen as the younger kind of upstart in that sense. And of course, Kennedy will win the nomination, but he will surprise many, and I think LBJ in particular, by picking LBJ to be his running mate. And in part, you know, they had been big rivals, but in part, LBJ was needed to keep that Democratic coalition together, that Democratic coalition that had been put together by FDR that contained Northern liberal Democrats and Southern conservative Democrats that was always threatening to come apart if one didn't pay careful attention to it. And Kennedy, a Catholic, oftentimes distrusted by Northerners, oftentimes distrusted by Southerners, threatened to, you know, kind of make those fissures come into better light. And LBJ was seen as somebody who, from the South, from Texas, also a master of the Senate, could help Kennedy in that sense. And so he was put on the ticket. LBJ was pretty crass. He was pretty crude. And the Kennedy people, the people around Kennedy, I should say, oftentimes disdained LBJ. That really rubbed LBJ the wrong way as well. And so there was not a good relationship there. And especially we know, you know, famously Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson very much disliked each other. But I think Kennedy was a practical enough politician to see LBJ for what he was and put him to use. And LBJ, we know, you know, really lobbied Kennedy for some particular portfolios, some of which Kennedy would go along with, some of which he, you know, he wouldn't. He lobbied for an office in the West Wing, and he didn't get that. Mm-hmm. He did get an office over in the executive office building. He got the, you know, kind of a couple of heads of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and he headed the National Aeronautics and Space Council for the president. And those are two things that, you know, he really used as platforms for himself.
If you've just joined us, Donna Hoffman is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Walsh, presidential historian. We're looking at vice presidents in historical perspective this hour and looking at various relationships between here. There was an ascension to the presidency by a vice president through an assassination. Of course, Tim, vice presidents hope to ascend to the presidency by just succeeding the president they serve. My note's failing me again. But how many vice presidents do happen to step into the shoes of the presidency after the president leaves office?
I think in total it's eight, but in fact the challenge is to succeed to the presidency immediately following your vice presidency. Mm-hmm. And only Martin Van Buren and George H.W. Bush have succeeded to immediately from being vice president of the United States to being president, because in a way you're tied to the policies and practices of your predecessor. And if it's been a person who's had 8 years in office, people are looking for change. And so that's been the challenge. I do want to kind of go back a little bit to what Donna said about the balance of the ticket, because why is a person selected as a vice presidential candidate? To balance out the weaknesses or limitations of the presidential candidate. And that's classic in what you see between Kennedy and Johnson, the Southern Protestant Democrat, master of the Senate, and the Irish Catholic from Massachusetts. You kind of see that with Carter and Mondale. Mm-hmm. The mold is broken with Gore and Clinton, because they're two Southerners from adjoining states about the same age. And so we no longer quite follow that practice.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of President Clinton from the year 2000, still president, endorsing his vice president for Al Gore's own presidential run in 2000. And Gore here promising to carry on Clinton's legacy. First, let's listen to Clinton. That'll be followed by an excerpt from Al Gore at this appearance in 2000.
I can tell you that as we move into the future, the nominee of the Democratic Party, my partner and friend for the last 8 years, understands where we are, where we're going, and how it will affect ordinary citizens more than any other public figure in this country over the last 20 years. He is the right person to be the first president of the 21st century, Al Gore. Bill Clinton worked hard to get this economy right. And I'm pledging to you here today, I am not going to let the other side wreck it and take it away from us. We're going to keep the prosperity going.
Okay, Donna Hoffman, a comment on that relationship, Clinton and Gore.
Yeah, they did have, they were both, as Tim mentioned, you know, kind of the same age from the same area of the country. Clinton from Arkansas, Gore from Tennessee. And Gore had served in the Senate. Gore had a political pedigree. His father had served in the Senate as well. Clinton was kind of more the upstart there. And they seemingly had a very good relationship as president and vice president. Gore was put in charge of what was called the National Performance Review. And that was a big initiative of the Clinton administration to essentially make government run more like a business, to take into account citizens' concerns when calling the Social Security Administration and various things like that. And so it was a big overview, a big review, if you will, of the bureaucracy that the president is the head of. And Al Gore headed that up. And that was a big portfolio for him. And, you know, we know Gore was regularly involved in key meetings, in giving advice, definitely being a partner in that. But interestingly enough, despite those clips that you played, Clinton certainly was all in on Gore's presidency and his bid for that.
Mm-hmm.
Gore, though, did seek to distance himself as he was running somewhat from the Clinton administration. And in part, that was due to the moral failings, the character failings, because Clinton had been impeached, of course, famously.
Mm-hmm.
And Gore probably didn't stress the economic things that had been done in the Clinton administration going forward, because he really was seeking in his campaign to carve out his own space as his own man, not just necessarily as Clinton's heir apparent, because of his concern with what the public would think about him as being part of the administration in which Bill Clinton had been impeached. And so he very much sought to distance himself from Clinton in some respects, and in particular not stressing the economy probably as much. Now, famously, you know, Gore would not go on to win the presidency, even though he would win the popular vote by about 500,000 votes. And so he's yet another one of those vice presidents who failed in terms of running in their own right for the presidency.
A presidency decided ultimately by the Supreme Court, and we remember that phrase, hanging chads in Florida, and all that comes rushing back, right, Tim?
But what Donna says is absolutely right, and if you listen to that quote from President Clinton, you know, my partner and friend, he is holding Gore close to his bosom. At the same time, Gore, as the candidate, wants to separate himself while taking the power and authority and achievement that he had as vice president, but not any of the cultural and political baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a problem for Hubert Humphrey, for example. Yes, they accomplished enormous things during the 1960s in terms of social programs, but he had the Vietnam War hanging around his neck, and he could not separate himself from Lyndon Johnson and the burden that Lyndon Johnson had brought to American politics. That's the burden of the vice president running for president immediately after having served as vice president.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Al Gore not becoming president, George W. Bush becoming president, his vice president, Dick Cheney. Let's hear a little bit of Dick Cheney. This is far removed from his time as vice president. This is from 2009. Cheney recognizes one of the most powerful vice presidents in U.S. history. Here he is. This is C-SPAN, a clip from C-SPAN. And here he is responding to criticisms that the Bush administration acted out of shock following the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
We did what we felt we had to do, and if I had it to do all over again, I would do exactly the same thing. I'd be just as tough and aggressive as I could to make certain that those individuals who wished us harm and who were prepared to kill thousands of Americans to achieve a political objective got what they had coming to them. And I think it was the right thing to do, and I don't have much tolerance or patience for those who suggest now the benefit of hindsight 8 years later, and who they've forgotten what in fact happened on 9/11.
Okay, so comment, Tim, on how Dick Cheney, how much power he had. We perceived him to have quite a bit of power. He had that much power.
One can make an argument that he's the most powerful vice president in history. And in part, it's because Dick Cheney had no ambitions to ever run for the presidency. So in that sense, he could be, and he also did not aspire to the kind of public attention that vice presidents often try to attract to them. So he could work behind the scenes. Add to that the portfolio that he brought to the Bush presidency as having served President Bush's father, President George H.W. Bush, as Secretary of Defense, having served Gerald Ford as Chief of Staff. He brought a certain gravitas and authority and experience, and along with Don Rumsfeld, the two of them really guided President George W. Bush, who was something of a neophyte, a one-term governor, in the direction of the country. And of course, in a way, nudged. I'm not saying that George W. Bush did not go into the war, just at the behest of Cheney and Rumsfeld, but their advice and George Tenet's advice took the country into war with Iraq. And that really shaped the future of the Bush presidency.
I'm recalling a political cartoon of the era. I think there were probably several like this. What I'm recalling is Dick Cheney as a puppet master and George W. Yeah. Bush as the puppet, Donna.
Right. And, you know, if you go back and you listen again to that clip that you played, you know, Cheney said he used the pronoun I. He didn't use the pronoun we. He used the pronoun I. If I'd been put in the same position today as I was then, I'd do exactly the same things.
Right. So who has the reins of power? Dick Cheney.
Exactly. And, you know, another thing about Dick Cheney's long service in government that Tim noted is that through that, and especially serving in the Nixon and Ford eras and going forward, especially in the aftermath of Watergate, Cheney took on a very expansive notion of executive power. And that's behind a lot of his actions in terms of what happened in the Bush administration related to in the aftermath of 9/11. But even absent that, he very much had an expansive view of executive power that he sought to exercise on behalf of the president, on behalf of the administration in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with Tim? Tim said earlier, since I think he said Mondale, the power of the vice presidency has, well, you know, two steps forward, one step back, perhaps, but generally increased if you would graph it out.
Yes, but, you know, Joe Biden, who would follow Dick Cheney, would be very critical of the Cheney model. So while we would still talk about Joe Biden as a powerful vice president, he's a different kind of vice president than Cheney is. So Cheney is both powerful, but Cheney is also very different, because it's going to be fairly rare that you do have that vice president that doesn't have any further political ambitions. I mean, even Joe Biden is still talking about running in 2020, and he toyed with it in 2016. And so that affects people, I think, different ways as well. And so Dick Cheney is really quite the anomaly at this point in time anyway. But definitely we do see, you know, those vice presidents kind of increasing. But at the same time, we could look at Mondale, fairly powerful, carving out a new role in terms of being a true partner with Carter. But then you get somebody like Dan Quayle. And Dan Quayle was really pretty much a non-entity in George H.W. Bush's one
term. We're going to talk about him in the second half hour. We have some famous audio from Dan Quayle and a senator from Texas. There's a little bit of trivia. You can fill in the blank there when we come back. We're talking all about vice presidents in historical perspective with Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Walsh, presidential historian and former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. What you're hearing now is not Hail to the Chief. This is a march called Hail Columbia. It used to be for the president, then it got relegated to, what, Tim, the vice presidency.
Right. Exactly.
And so this is when a vice president enters the room, what you will often hear.
That's right, and unknown to most people.
Okay. Hail Columbia.
Hail Columbia.
Okay. River to River, back with more on vice presidents and historical perspective. Tim Walsh, Donna Hoffman, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Fascinating hour putting, well, our present politics, not speaking about those, but putting our present politics in the historical context of vice presidents throughout history. 48 vice presidents have served the U.S., 14 have become presidents, and we're talking about some of the different roles they have played, how they have served their presidents in different ways, their relationships with the presidents, sometimes a cold relationship, sometimes a close one. Always a fascinating and complicated relationship, it turns out, when you are a heartbeat away from the presidency. Donna Hoffman is with us, associate professor and chair of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Walsh, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. One name is so connected with the vice presidency. I have to mention it because it stretches over decades. Richard Nixon, vice president to Eisenhower in the 1950s, and then going on in the 60s into the 70s, and then leaving office, resigning, or I guess our only president to resign, right? Set the scene there, Tim, back in his early days as a vice president, right. His relationship with Eisenhower.
Well, it really starts as a candidate because Eisenhower didn't know Nixon. But Nixon, again, as Donna referenced earlier, in terms of balancing the ticket, was this capable senator, crusading anti-communist from California to balance the seasoned veteran of World War II, the crusader who saved Europe, on the Republican ticket in 1952. But as time went on through the campaign, of course, Nixon got into trouble because of a Republican slush fund, and it was Ike was being encouraged to replace him on the ticket. Mm-hmm. Well, Nixon, using the relatively new medium of television, got on the air, and of course, folks will remember the Checkers speech, kind of pleading his case. So effectively using a new media. Checkers, the name of a dog that they were given. He said his wife, Pat, had a good Republican cloth coat, and they were going to keep this little dog that they'd given to his daughters, but he wasn't guilty of anything else. And so he effectively stayed on the ticket and then, you know, played an important role for Eisenhower, kind of doing the president's bidding, particularly when the president wanted to take a kind of a darker side, a criticism of some policy. And so in that sense, Nixon becomes the attack dog of the Republican administration. One thing also that was a crisis for both vice president and president at that time was Ike had a heart attack. And so the question was, well, should Nixon take over temporarily? And this was not clarified until, of course, we got the 25th Amendment in the 1960s, which clarified when a vice president should take over for the president, mm-hmm. how that would be facilitated. And then, of course, it goes on from there. I'll let Donna add to the story.
Right. So we have Nixon losing to Kennedy in a very close 1960 race. Take it through into the 60s, Donna, with Nixon's evolution here and ascendancy to the presidency.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about the Checker speech, which was in 1952 when he was the vice presidential candidate, is that he's going to effectively use this new medium, television, and it worked for the most part. But in 1960, one of the famous things that we talk about in the 1960 campaign is the first televised debates between Nixon and Kennedy, and there was a series of those. And in the first one, especially, the television did not show Nixon in a good light. So he had successfully used this medium before. Now not so much in this first debate, where he had been ill. His 5 o'clock shadow was showing. He was sweating. At one point, the moderator asked him, you know, if he wants to respond to something Kennedy has said. And he says, no. You know, he just didn't say anything. You would never have a candidate do that.
Unthinkable, right?
Now, exactly. And so that's one of the ironies of Nixon's early career. And so he, in a narrow campaign in 1960, is, of course, defeated by Kennedy and goes on to, you know, at one point say that you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. He has a very, from the Checker speech as well, though I should add here, he has a very confrontational relationship with the media from that point on, because it was the media that had exposed this fund. And Nixon, kind of always somewhat paranoid, always seen as kind of having that imposter syndrome, I think, he wasn't good enough to be with the establishment. That was his kind of view. Would from there forward always have a confrontational relationship with the media. And then as he becomes president and Watergate breaks, that, of course, will further that relationship in a very negative way.
Interesting, Donna, that you should bring up confrontation or hostile feelings toward the media. Spiro Agnew is the man that Richard Nixon picks as his vice president. His running mate becomes president in 1968. Spiro Agnew, let's listen to a little bit of Spiro Agnew, the vice president, and his calling out to television media. This is part of a 1969 speech given by Spiro Agnew in Des Moines.
Monday night, a week ago, President Nixon delivered the most important address of his administration, one of the most important of our decade. His subject was Vietnam. My hope, as his, at that time, was to rally the American people, to see the conflict through to a lasting and just peace in the Pacific. For 32 minutes, he reasoned with a nation that has suffered almost 250,000 casualties in the longest war in its history. When the president completed his address, an address, incidentally, that he spent weeks in the preparation of, his words and policies were subjected to instant analysis and querulous criticism. The audience of 70 million Americans gathered to hear the President of the United States was inherited by a small band of network commentators and self-appointed analysts, the majority of whom expressed in one way or another their hostility to what he had to say.
Wow, back to 1969, timid compared to what we hear today, Don, there in terms of painting the news media, certainly not using any words like enemy of the people.
No, certainly. But, you know, the undertone is there. We know that that was a speech actually written by Pat Buchanan. And we also know that the networks covered that speech live, which would be very unusual for someone who's the vice president in that era. And this was, you know, obviously something that Spiro Agnew particularly did for Nixon. He was oftentimes sent out to attack specifically political opponents. And then in this clip, you hear him attacking the press as well.
Mm-hmm. So the attack dog role, Tim.
Exactly. I mean, Nixon defined for Agnew the role he felt he had been assigned by Ike. And so he, in a way, doubled down on it because Nixon had such a dark side toward the press. As Donna alluded to, the challenges he faced in 1960 and again in 1962 when he ran for governor of California, so bitter about the press, he consulted advertising. H.R. Haldeman, folks may not remember, was in Madison Avenue Advertising. And so they marketed Richard Nixon in 1968 like they would any other kind of product. So he was quite cynical about the press and the media. And that's where you get this dark side with Spiro Agnew. And then takes us to the next unusual chapter in vice presidential history, which, of course, is the discovery by the press and then the prosecutors in Baltimore that Spiro Agnew had been taking payoffs and graft and corruption back to the days when he'd been governor of Maryland and was forced to resign as vice president. Well, had we not had a 25th Amendment, we would not have been able to, President Nixon, who also at that point was in trouble, would not have been able to select Gerald Ford to become our vice president. And then, of course, once Nixon was forced to resign, Gerald Ford goes from being an unelected vice president to being an unelected president. So it was a real constitutional crisis between vice president and president.
Fascinating hour with Tim Walsh and Donna Hoffman as we discuss vice presidents in U.S. history and historical perspective. A couple of other clips I wanted to get to. I would be remiss in not playing journalists in radio think in terms of what is good audio, what is audio that you connect with vice presidents. This is certainly at the top of that list, the takedown in a 1988 vice presidential debate. The vice presidential debaters there, Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas, running with Michael Dukakis on the Democratic ticket, calling out Republican vice presidential candidate Dan Quayle, who was had been selected by George H.W. Bush as his running mate. Let's listen to this famous takedown, which takes us back to the 60s.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator Benson.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You're only taking time
is to call in the joint
your own candidate.
That was really uncalled for, Senator.
You're the one that was making the comparison, Senator, and I'm one who knew him well, and frankly I think you're so far apart in the objectives you choose for your country that I did not think the comparison was well taken.
Senator Lloyd Benson on the Michael Dukakis ticket, the loser in that presidential campaign, George H.W. Bush winning with Dan Quayle as the vice president. Donna, comment on George H.W. Bush's selection of Dan Quayle, how it's viewed in historical perspective now.
Well, George H.W. Bush had ran in 1980 against Ronald Reagan. In fact, he won the Iowa caucuses over Reagan in 1980. And during that campaign, which George H.W. Bush would, of course, lose to Reagan, he called Reagan's economic plan voodoo economics. So George H.W. Bush was, you know, very much New England establishment Republican, and he was distrusted somewhat. And in 1988, when George H.W. Bush would run in his own right, he would come in, I think, third in the Iowa caucuses. And though he would go on to get the nomination. So he was seen as keeping up maybe with the evolution of the Republican Party, because from 80 to 88, evangelical Christians in particular had garnered importance in securing the Republican nomination. And so George H.W. Bush would go on to get that. But Dan Quayle was the darling of the conservatives. And so George H.W. Bush was a little distrusted, I think, in some quarters there. And certainly Quayle was young. He did have some political experience, as he referred to, you know, having the same amount as John F. Kennedy. But he was picked by and large for the fact that he was young. He was fresh, but he was popular with conservatives. And George H.W. Bush needed to shore up their support of him in that particular election.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on Dan Quayle, Tim?
Well, he was, as Donna suggests, he was a darling of the right, but not really seen as vice presidential timber. In fact, there was a rumor going around in 1988 that George H.W. Bush was selecting an Indiana senator to be vice president, and Dick Lugar was all ready for the press conference.
Right?
No one thought Quayle. But from George H.W. Bush's perspective, the idea was he'd made a bold selection, a young man from a new generation, who had, in fact, reached across the aisle, had worked with Senator Ted Kennedy in sponsoring the Joint Training and Partnership Act, which was very powerful. So he did have some credibility, and he did have what he claimed, which was the same amount of experience as Jack Kennedy. But people forget, of course, because of this Kennedy assassination and the Kennedy presidency, which was still kind of in the afterglow, that people thought of Jack Kennedy as a lightweight to take on the office of president. So, unfortunately, Dan Quayle walked right into that, and that bold decision became problematic because, of course, he stumbled, and every time he made a speech, there would be some malaprop, how do you spell the word potato, or any number of things, and he became something of a joke, and that's always a danger with the vice presidents. And anybody who's watched Veep, for example, knows that we can joke about the vice president, and in fact, he's been a character in various Broadway comedies and other roles as well.
Mm-hmm. As we conclude this hour, I want to get to one of the closest relationships in modern presidency between a president and a vice president. Let's listen to this clip during President Obama's time in office toward the end, surprising a teary-eyed Vice President Joe Biden with a Presidential Medal of Freedom Presidential Medal of Freedom before he formally left the White House. Here's what Biden, often referred to as, referring to Obama as his brother, in fact. This is what he had to say after receiving that surprise award.
Every single thing you've asked me to do, Mr. President, you have trusted me to do. And that is a, that's a remarkable thing. I don't think, according to, I see the president of Georgetown here as well, I don't think, according to the presidential and vice presidential scholars, that kind of relationship has existed. I mean, for real. It's all you, Mr. President. It's all you. The reason why when you send me around the world, nothing gets, as my mom would say, gets missed between the cup and the lip is because they know when I speak for you. And it's been easy, Mr. President, because we not only have the same political philosophy and ideology, I tell everybody, and I've told them from the beginning, and I'm not saying this to reciprocate, I've never known a president, and few people I've ever met my whole life, I can count on less than one hand, who've had the integrity and the decency and the sense of other people's needs like you do.
Okay, heartfelt words from Vice President Joe Biden talking about President Obama and near the end of the President Obama's time in office. Donna, has there been a personal chemistry like that?
I don't think there has been. And, you know, of course, you know, in an era in which we don't have the video clips and audio clips, that's kind of hard to assess. But at least in the modern era, you know, it was fairly obvious when the two of them were in the same room that they had a mutual respect, that they had a very different relationship, that I think that clip, you know, kind of in that whole ceremony, if you watch that whole ceremony, it's very touching because Biden didn't know this was happening. Obama surprised him with it. You know, as you mentioned, he tears up. But I do think they really had a very different relationship. You had some of the relationship that you saw with Mondale and Carter in terms of being true advisor, the weekly lunches, you know, involved in key decisions. And Mondale and Carter were close, but I don't think they felt like brothers. And Mondale would, you know, run later for the presidency, and he would have to talk about his Carter relationship. And it wasn't talked about in terms of, you know, we were brothers, as you can imagine, if Joe Biden were to run for president in the next cycle, how he might talk about President Obama and how we have had him talk about President Obama. So a very unique relationship there as well. So some elements of things we've seen before, but then some new things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Biden greatly admired President Obama when he ran for office in 2008. In fact, made the case to President Obama that he, Joe Biden, could be a real asset as vice president because he brought all that senatorial experience. So he was invested in that administration, the Obama administration, even before he became the candidate for vice president. So that bond, as Donna suggests, is a special one. It's a brotherhood that's it's not unlike, I suppose, members of the same platoon. You know, you stay bonded with that individual because of your common experience.
Okay, we've got 2 or 3 minutes left. Let's talk about the present day as of July 2018. Vice President Pence serving his president, Donald Trump. With all this historical context that you've shared and that you have, that you haven't shared here, Donna, how would you characterize Vice President Pence, when we look at the history of vice presidents and the roles that they have played?
I think I'd have to characterize Pence at the moment anyway as kind of a tightrope walker. He is sort of keeping a low profile. He defends Trump when he needs to, does his bidding. You know, famously, he walked out of the Indianapolis Colts game to protest the NFL athletes who were kneeling. And it's very clear that Mike Pence has ambition to be president himself. But it's clear to me that if you watch him carefully, I think that he is keeping his finger to the wind that is the GOP base. And Donald Trump is very popular with the GOP base. So there's no reason right now for Mike Pence to criticize the president because that's not going to be in his interest right now. But should those winds shift, I think then you would see a different Mike Pence, maybe being saying things very, very different. But again, that tightrope walker managing a president who's unpopular, generally speaking, but very popular with the base. And he's someone who obviously wants to be president himself.
Mm-hmm. Your read on Pence?
Well, it's interesting. I think the roles are reversed between, we say, the Nixon-Agnew model, where Agnew was the attack vice presidency. Mm-hmm. We have an attack president in President Trump. He says what he wants to say and says it directly. And it's Vice President Trump who kind of calms the waters, gives people a sense, well, you know, there's reason and order and a kind of a smoothing things over in a voice that's got a measured tone to it. So it's a completely different mix, a model between president and vice president.
Tim, I don't hear about these two having lunch as previous presidents have.
Oddly enough, they do have lunch, but they always have another person in the room too with them, unlike the Putin-Trump meetings where there isn't anybody but a translator.
So that's true.
It is true. They do have weekly meetings, but they often have one or two other people there to keep the conversation going. So I'm told. Mm-hmm. This is what I hear from the press.
Pence and Trump, Donna, are they close from what you can tell?
It doesn't appear to be that way. And, you know, I'm not sure that Trump is close with anyone really outside of his family. And I think that's been true over his career as well. And so you don't see that same kind of relationship that, for example, you saw with Obama and Biden.
Right.
So again, a very different kind of relationship because they're very two different personalities. And and you know, Mike Pence, it was interesting. Tim mentioned the lunch and, you know, other people being there. Mike Pence famously has said he, you know, refuses to dine alone with women other than his wife if other people aren't there.
Right.
And so again, he's that darling of the evangelical crowd that were very at
point.
Least at one point uncomfortable with Trump.
Okay, we'll have to end it there with some dinner conversation or comment about dinner conversation. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Walsh, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. What a fascinating hour. Thanks for putting this in context for us.
Thanks, Ben. Hey,
you're welcome.
River to River, produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.